Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Forgotten Sacramento Murders 1940 to 1976 explores the crimes by Sacramento's greatest generation. The murders that shocked Sacramento two generations ago are now only remembered by a handful of people. But during its time, they startled Sacramento to its very core, including the original boogeyman who in 1956 murdered a young boy in a downtown movie theater's men's room. The mad basher of 1941 who disappeared after his spree, only to reappear in 1956 to kill five more. Teenager Raymond Latshaw grew tired of his abusive father, so he killed him, his new wife, stepbrother and grandparents in 1943. From 1949 to 1951, hobo Lloyd Gomez murdered eight men in hobo camps up and down the Central Valley. His conscience caught up to him after he murdered a fellow hobo for a couple bottles of beer in Sacramento. The despicable Robert Nicholas, the CSU Sacramento graduate who murdered his three small children in 1964 and was astonishingly paroled in 1977. This evil man stewed in hatred for his ex-wife, murdering her in 1985. He died in prison. The unsolved double murder of grocery store clerks Philip Latimer and Michael McCandless in 1965. In 1958, Sacramento media was turned on its head after local television personality Ogden Miles was found murdered in a stubble field near Antelope. A violent same-sex tryst doomed the married father of two. Sacramento has a long and sordid history of murder, beginning with the murderous founder, John Sutter, who thought nothing of killing Native Americans, to the recently captured Joseph DeAngelo, who is accused of being the Golden State Killer. Sacramento has a reputation for creepy murders. The book that we're featuring this evening is Forgotten Sacramento Murders, 1940 to 1976, with my special guest journalist and author, David Kulchik. Welcome back to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, David Kulchik.
Hey, thanks for having me on again. It's always an honor.
I hope I pronounced your last name properly. It's been a little while, so.
Yep. Yeah, you did. You did it perfect.
There we go. Thank you very
much.
We are
kind of from the same Slavic stock, you know. So.
Yeah, we do have that. You got to kind of ask. You got to make sure. You know,
yeah.
Is that the way to pronounce
yeah.
it? I mean, I think I'm looking at these vowels and consonants properly.
Yeah.
Congratulations
well, we
on this book, Forgotten Sacramento Murders.
Thank you. This is
congratulations.
A book that. This book is kind of came out because of my other books. I had so much information, so many files on all these other murders. And I thought, you know, I love this city. Sacramento is one of the greatest cities, I think, in the America. So it's laid back. It has a porch culture because of the heat. It has a very strong evening culture. That goes back since it started, you know, siestas and all that. And it's a great city. It's basically in a forest. So, So our Golden State murder, the East Side rapist, that happened in the neighborhood right where I live now. And my wife was about 12 years old when it was happening. And, you know, that's when everybody got steel doors for their front door and all that. And you know what? Everyone knew he was a cop. Before any of this even happened, and you talk about the East Side Killer, everyone would say, oh, he was a cop. And he was a cop.
Yeah. There was a lot of correct people, but it's a, still an amazing, incredible story, and Sacramento is certainly again on the map.
Yeah. For some reason, crazy murders happen here.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. As demonstrated in this book, let's get to some of those right now. Separate the two stories because there is a gap in time, but we'll put those together. They call him the Mad Basher in an introduction. We call him that, but you call him the Mad Killer in the book. And so we talk about the Mad Killer returns, but there is the Mad Killer of 1941 and then later 1957 to 1958. So I could say a 16-year gap. Let's talk about the Mad Killer of 1941, and you have the victims as Ramon Rivas and Alfred Reed, and then three John Does, 1, 2, and 3.
Right. There was also a man,
tell us a little
John
bit of
Sanders, who was beaten and survived. Sacramento has always been the end of the line, and on the around Sacramento is, you know, the Great Sacramento Valley and the San Joaquin Valley. Everything grows here, you know. So they need a lot of transient workers, and, you know, and honest to God cowboys, especially back in 1941. And so they would find these guys, and it still happens today where they find them in a slough. There's a lot of little channels out here for irrigation all the fields and stuff. And even now they find people, you know, decomposed in the slough, you know. But in 1941, it got a little crazy because all five of them showed up. Oh, actually, more than that, but the five of them for sure that were beaten to death. And it was in the summer of 1941. First guy they found, he was outside of town. He was too decomposed to identify, and they believed him to be Mexican or Filipino heritage, about 20 years old. He'd been dead for a while, about 8 months. Then on August 20th, they found Davis rancher Alfred Reed, and he was by this bridge. And oddly enough, the area is still pretty rural. It's still in Sacramento, but it's very rural area. It's by the airport. And they found this, these shepherds found this guy, Alfred Reed, and he was all beat up, you know, broken hip and everything. And he was able to tell the police that he had been drinking with a man under the I Street Bridge. There's only like two bridges in Sacramento, and the I Street Bridge is one of them. It's a railroad and a car bridge. It's 100 and something years old. And so the hobos and people, well, it's right next to Old Sac. And Old Sacramento now is a state park in California system, and it's all made up. So it's a Wild West town. And that only happened since the 70s. For 130 years, it was where you would go to pick up a hooker or to buy heroin or to drink crazy or whatever you wanted. It was like the den of vice, our red light district. Right. And since they fixed it up, they tore down, they had all these, you know, facades on it, tore it off, and there's like the old West facades. And so now it's like where you go for, you know, you take visitors to check out. But back then it was a real dangerous place where homeless men got loaded out of their gorge. So they were drinking under the bridge, and the guy was going to give him a ride back to his ranch, and he took him the wrong way and beat him an inch of his life. After the police and the ambulance came, they didn't know, but a few yards away from that guy was another victim named John Sanders, who was found just like an hour after the ambulances all left. It's kind of, you think about police and the way they do things back then, you would think that they would form a circle and, you know, and secure the crime scene or anything. But, you know, here 6-7 feet away was another guy, and they didn't even see him because of the tall grass and stuff, you know.
Right.
So they find that guy, and he was pretty messed up too. And but evidently he said that he bought a bottle of wine, and next thing he remembers waking up in the hospital. He was really beaten up. the Reed guy, the first guy they found, ended up dying a couple of days later, and that Sanders guy recovered and left Sacramento. And nowadays I find that very odd, just as a journalist, that journalists wouldn't have, you know, got a hold of him and given him a few drinks and find out his side of the story. But it wasn't like that in those days. So just 4 days after Reed and Sanders were attacked, Ramon Rivas shows up, not too far away from where the other crime scene was, and he was already dead. His wallet was missing. He'd been in the water for a couple of days. Some other bodies showed up. There's one, one of the John Does, kind of became famous because this story, I heard of this story quite a while ago, like when I first moved to Sacramento, and it was written down in some websites and stuff like that. And this, they found, along with this guy, was a felt hat from L's Style Shop on K Street. And, you know, they tried their best to try to figure out where, you know, who this guy was, but they never could. Funny thing is that later on, in, maybe 20 years ago, L's Style Shop was like a underground punk rock nightclub.
Right.
So, you know, and then when I found that, I was like, hey, L's Style Shop, whoa. So, yeah, the newspapers had a pretty good day with it. They called him the Insane Slayer, the Mad Killer, the Basher. They were always in competition for each other, the Union and the Bee. And the police said they made it their top priority. But then again, old Sacramento, during that time, just before that time, it was exposed that a bunch of police officers actually owned some of those buildings that were, you know, whorehouses and illegal gambling joints and stuff. So the cops didn't really want to dig too much into their little money-making area. Pearl Harbor happens, and the guy disappears. Nobody dies after that. So there's always been this thought that this guy, because he was extremely strong, he was like a gorilla. He beat these people to death. And there's a big thought that he was a Air Force member, because Sacramento had two major Air Force bases on its north and south side, Mather Field and McClellan Field. McClellan Field is where the Doolittle Raiders planes were all outfitted, and a very major place. Mather was a big training base for navigators. And this guy disappeared, and they never saw him. They thought maybe he was in the military, and when the war happened, he got transferred out. No one ever, it just stopped just like that.
You also say that other jurisdictions in Yuhaw County, Sutter, and Sacramento counties,
right,
and Yolo also wanted to clear those cases, and you kind of questioned that. So what you saw was maybe a little bit baseless. What did you see with tying those cases,
well,
those five other new ones, to those other five?
Yeah, the cases that I have down here are the ones that I could really nail down. Like the other ones were, you know, Yolo County is still a very rural county, and Sutter County, they're all very, you know, even now they're kind of cowboy counties. And so they cleared off their board with a lot of these floaters that they found that they were victims of the Mad Killer, so that they didn't have to investigate it anymore. They could clear it up as a case. I've been too involved in California crimes to really, especially in those days, to believe, you know, police actions. Because, you know, back in those days, you became a police officer because, you know, Uncle Joe's kid couldn't find a job after he got out of the Army. You know, it was kind of a last resort job. It wasn't a career where you went to college for, like it is now.
Well, you can still have people with not the best intentions or motivations to join a police force, too. So see some of that.
Right.
I think it depends. But, yeah, things were much different. Let's put it that way. Now, you talk about the Mad Killer return.
Mm-hmm. 1957, murder started to happen just out of the blue. Odd thing is, too, is that this guy could have been military and been transferred back to Sacramento, But then again, that's like a 18 year gap. And that is about the average that you get in California for a homicide, like a second degree homicide murder case. So
right.
He might have been arrested for a completely different crime and sent to prison for it. But in 1957, in March, Walter Wayne Imes, 37-year-old dairy truck driver, who was a very conscientious guy, he's got never missed work, and all his customers loved him. He went missing on March 8th, 1957. And that's the time when things start melting around here and the rivers start getting a little wild and things start getting green by March in Sacramento. So he didn't show up for work. A couple of days later, they found his brand new pickup truck parked outside of Auburn, California, which is about 40 miles up the American River and up I-80 too. This guy was not an outdoorsy guy. There was like no reason. His family were just, they were like, what would he be doing up there? You know, 1957, people weren't out hiking around in the woods like they do now or for the last 30 years or so. You know, that wasn't something that average people did back then. So on March 30th, almost like 3 weeks later, a fisherman discovers his bloated, battered body in the American River about 5 miles downstream from his truck. And he had a crease in his forehead. And they, you know, didn't know what to do about it. You know, it's like, is this a murder? Is this a drowning? His wife received some mysterious phone calls that said that the authorities know who killed your husband and things like that. And she just changed her phone number. Then in August 4th, Dwayne Darwood Dow, which, can you believe that name?
Yeah.
Darwood. Wow, man. So he actually knew Ames. They lived just a couple blocks away from each other. We're pretty close in the age. He's a 39-year-old salesman, and he was last seen cashing a check at a bottle shop, and he was supposed to be going to church. About a month and a half later, they find him strangled in a remote area, not too far from the American River. It was all wild back then. It was all just ranchland. Now there's a lot of houses and things there, and you know, subdivisions and roads and all that. But back then, it was still very wild. Actually, where I live right now, just until 1960, was hop fields in the entire area for miles. So now it's like wall-to-wall houses. So he had been beaten to death. His skull and larynx were fractured. Now, I find this really odd. His wallet laid on the log, and there's an empty bottle or wine bottle on top of it. So for that long, no one, 6 weeks, no one even went around that area. I just find that so, you know, so different than what it is like now. And another thing, there's no mention of them doing dusting for fingerprints on the wine bottle, which I found it's like, well, there's another, you know, cop misunderstanding. So then just a few weeks later, on September, actually just 3 days after they found Dowd, Charles Schrader, as 18-year-old Coast Guard reservist, and he told his mom he was going to hitchhike to another part of town, northern part of town called Rio Linda, see some friends. And he was found, his body naked, in the American River the next day, just not too far from the river. His head was bashed in. So November 9th, Thomas O'Dell, he was a 17-year-old sailor from Yuba City. It's about 30 miles north of Sacramento. He joined the Navy to see the world, and he ended up being stationed at Treasure Island, which is just underneath the Bay Bridge in San Francisco. So he's like stationed 100 miles from where he grew up. Not going to see the world. He was found almost decapitated and naked in a ditch off Arden Way. 200 feet from Fair Oaks Boulevard, which is now it's like a total populated place. Back then it was fields, I guess. He was killed with a meat cleaver, and his spinal cord was severed at the base of his neck. Now, he was found naked. Now, the police, they said that these weren't sexual assaults. they stressed that in the paper. And by the late 50s, they could actually say stuff like that. But everyone was wondering, you know, what happened here. The sailor, that Odell guy, he was all over town that day in Sacramento. People saw him all over the place, and it just made things really confusing and complicated for the police because they had so many places they had to run down, so many leads they had to go after. But they couldn't find out much more. And he was seen with people that looked extremely different from each other, and there was no, like, one set person he was with. So on April 24th, 1958, Mary Yoakum spooned her husband, Jake. He had a junkyard, asked him to stop and get something on the way home from the store. And he got distracted, lost track of time. And when he arrived home at his house, his wife was gone. The house was dark. And he wasn't too perturbed. He drove to their favorite hangout, the Pioneer Club, which was a bucket of blood place. I have another chapter about a murder that happened in the Pioneer Club. It was, I've talked to some old timers and they were like, I wouldn't even go into that place, you know? And, now it's like a overpass. It was like so evil. They put an overpass over it. So, she was over at that club with her brother-in-law having a beer. And that place was, it was like their local tavern. They had a very large extended family and they all, bar hopped together and things. And, so Jake saw she was there and she was safe and that, and he just went home, didn't think anything of it. And, she wasn't home when he got up the next morning. He thought, well, you know, maybe she's at a friend's house or maybe she's at, you know, his sister's house or something like that. And, she didn't call or anything. So they had no kids. They were married for 15 years and they, had a pretty easygoing relationship. They liked to go camping and hunting and bowl together. And they really had their extended family. They really did a lot of stuff together, especially drink. So, you know, everybody in the family was like looking for it. It was like, wow, what happened? You know, Mary worked at a paint store too, and was like well-liked and did a great job. And, you know, wasn't like she was this, you know, bar person really bad, you know. So he was driving around, he spent one weekend looking for her, and when she went there, she was wearing her hair in curlers and a scarf over her head like they used to do back then. So it's not like she was out, you know, looking for a hot date or anything. So by 5 days later, Jake was ready to file a missing report, and the police showed up at his junkyard and they found her body on East Levy Road. Which is only probably, as the crow flies, maybe 5 miles from where they lived.
Right.
It was a isolated lover's lane type place. And she was found with her throat slit and her underwear ripped off, her skirt. She was obviously raped and stuff. Just a pretty bad mess. And she was also in advanced stages of decomposing pretty bad. That was in April, too, which is, it's starting to warm up there. No, that was in November. Yeah. And, yeah, so she was a mess. And Jake was really upset, you know, as he said, you know, he can't figure out anything. A woman that lived nearby said that she saw a dark green older model car sitting out there, but because it was a lover's lane place, she didn't pay much attention to it. Now, the mad basher was also reported driving a, like, olive drab, older sedan-type thing, which makes you think military, right? So,
right.
So they couldn't find a thing about it. Later on that year, some school kids found a charred wallet. We always have grass fires here, so that's not unusual. And it had money in it and some receipts and her driver's license and things, and it was a mystery. They never solved any of those crimes at all, those five. And I find it very odd that I just stumbled across it myself as I was doing this research and put this together, that I think that it was the same mad basher from 1941. There was 16 years gap between the murders. So either he was a lifer in the military and he's transferred because of World War II coming on, and maybe he was transferred back towards the end of his career to Sacramento, which happens a lot. You get mustered out in, you know, Sacramento, San Francisco and stuff. Those older cars that were green could have been military. It might have been an MP or something like that. But no one has ever found, no one has ever solved any of those crimes of the two 16-year instances. They had a lot in common. Six of the eight were middle-aged men. And the last two were sailors, and they were like in uniform. So he might have had some kind of thing against them, either because of the military or because they were sailors, or who knows, maybe because they were young and dumb, and because he obviously hunted his prey. And but I think Mary Yoakum, I think that was thrown in because she's the only female involved in it, and she was like 36 years old. I think that this guy like had a hatred for everyone. And I think him seeing her as a strong, independent woman walking to her car from the parking lot of the Pioneer Club, you know, hair up in curlers and, you know, not all dressed up or anything. I think it might have done something to him to make him go off and kill her. But I think it's too close that that she is part of the whole link with the other murders. And that happened 60 years ago. There's no way they'd be alive these days.
I found it interesting when you, I'm not too questioned your connecting the two, but it just seemed when you threw in Mary Yoakum and then you have the sailors, the young people, and then the guys that have some little bit of a connection, this would really drive up, you know, not to give too much merit to profiling necessarily, because everybody's individualistic, but these are pretty varied motivations. If you have the woman and then you have, you know, I mean, at least for profiling, you would say, well, that would lead people into different conclusions, wouldn't it?
I would think so, but because they happen so close together within a year,
right?
I think I see a pretty good connection there. And most of these people were also, half of them were associated with the north side of Sacramento, too. So perhaps he lived up in that area. Or actually, the north side of the base is, the north side of town is where McAllen Air Force Base was. And Mary Yoakum worked there during the war. So maybe, you know, she recognized him. Or, you know, he recognized her. Because that's how they found her, because her fingerprints were on file with the military.
And the connection with the American River. Let's talk about another case that we introduced in the introduction, the Renaissance murderer and Robert Nicolaus. And victims in 1964 and 1985. This is a very, very interesting guy. We talked about in the introduction that he's an educated guy. Tell us a little bit about Robert Nicolaus.
Robert Nicolaus was a Sacramento guy, born and raised. He's intelligent, an eccentric man. He had a bachelor's degree in psychology from my alma mater, California State University in Sacramento. And he worked for the Department of Motor Vehicles, and Sacramento's the state capital. So it's you know, good to get a state job. We have a highly educated workforce. And so, you know, he took a job there. And before he was in college, he was in real estate, and he also worked at McAllen Air Base and been a social worker. So when he was also in the Air Force, too. He could never stick to one thing. He would get fascinated by a subject, a religion, or a political belief, and he would learn everything about it and become radicalized with it, and then he'd get bored with it and leave it aside and go on to his next kick. Some of the subjects he was obsessed with was military, aircraft, history, biology. He rejected his Catholic upbringing, became a communist, atheist, a Marxist. Then he became a Nazi and started having big racist ideas. his first wife was Norma Jean Laura. They all lived down the north side of town too. She got tired of him. She divorced him. They had a kid. And he paid his child support and did everything he could. He was deep down inside. He wanted to have custody of his two kids that he had with her. And so he worked a couple of jobs, did all kinds of things to make more money just so that he could afford an attorney to get more custody or to get total custody. So he ends up marrying this woman named Charlize Morehouse, and everyone called her Lisa. And she was 15 years old, high school student, when he got married. And they had one daughter named Heidi. And they lived in a pretty crappy apartment. It's still a crappy apartment. He worked three jobs to get money for his attorney and things. And in May of 1964, his new wife, Lisa, had enough. She wasn't seeing them. She was still in high school. She was a senior in high school with a two-year-old baby. And she said she wanted to move back home with her parents and stuff. And he took the understanding way and said, yeah, we could use a break, whatever. They were planning on going to Lake Tahoe for a long-planned weekend. So they said, well, let's not break our plans or anything. It's not like they were mad at each other. She just couldn't stand living with somebody who wasn't home, and she was just a kid and, in a really tiny apartment. So the next day, it was a Saturday, and Bob went to his first wife's, picked up the kids, and said that he was going to take them to get their photographs with their daughter too. So she dressed up the kids in their best clothes, and he drove away, four of them all together, three kids. They went to a toy store and he spent $10 on them. That's a lot of money back then for toys, a Frisbee was like 68 cents. So, after they went out to eat and he got toys, they drove to the end of a dead end road, not too far away from his in-laws. He opened the trunk and asked children to jump inside to find the key that he had lost. Sure. And the kids jumped in there. He pulled out a 38 caliber revolver and shot each in the head twice. The littlest one got four bullets because he wanted to empty his gun twice. So he shot them all in the head, closed the trunk, and went to Lake Tahoe. And they drank and gambled and danced and went back to their motel room. And early in the morning, he had a panic attack. They took him to the hospital, and he admitted to the police of what he had done. Now, everyone was really shocked by this. You have three children. The guy shot his three children in the head multiple times in the trunk, and then he left the car abandoned, just sitting there to be found. Pretty hideous crime. And it really shook up the town a lot. So he, all these psychiatrists, this is the usual recommendation. One said he was insane, one said he couldn't have been insane, but he had a jury. His jury was made up of eight mothers and four fathers. He did not have one single person on the jury that didn't have kids. They found him guilty, sentenced him to death. And he appealed the verdict. In 1967, his sentence was reduced to life. And then they got rid of the death penalty in 1972 for like 8-9 years. And they paroled him in 1977, which is incredible. Just unbelievable. Yeah. 10 years. He got 10 years killing three children.
Yeah.
So, it's just, outrageous. So he gets out of prison, and he's stalking his second wife, Lisa. She had gotten remarried and took her husband's name and everything. They had four kids. But by 1985, she was estranged from her husband, and they lived in an apartment with other kids. The kids were like 3 to 16. And from all reports, she was just a person who would go out of her way. She was a very religious person, and she would have prayer sessions in her house, bringing people in her apartment from people that were just down their luck or whatever, feeling bad in their apartment building. Somebody needed a ride. She gave them a ride, and that this is what got her. So Nicholas got this self-admitted alcoholic, Pasquale D'Antonellini, and he asked her to set up a meeting with her, and he gave him $30 and some free booze. So this alcoholic guy, he asked Lisa if he could help him move. And she was like, yeah, sure. So she met him in front of a grocery store at 11 a.m. And she had her son in the back seat. He was only 3 years old. So he directed her to drive down this alley and told her to stop behind this apartment building. And he got out and left. And Nicholas comes pulling in, blocks her car, gets out and starts punching her. And the little kid's in the back seat just screaming, you know. And the girl stopped, went back to his car, got a gun, and fired two shots into her and killed her. First shot killed her. And she lived long enough to tell the police that it was her ex-husband that had shot her. And they arrested the D'Antonellino within 24 hours. And he sang like a bird, of course. He was a patsy. He didn't know that he was gonna murder her. He just thought that he wanted to talk to her. So he did that little trick there. So Nicholas, he ends up on the FBI's 10 most wanted list. He's gone for about a couple months, about six months. They find him in New York, Pennsylvania. He fought extradition all the way. They brought him back to Sacramento. They had to move the trial to Santa Clara County, which is down San Jose. They said it was a case called a nationwide uproar with law and order types, and they used him as an example of people being soft on criminals. You know, and in one case, this is where they actually were soft on a criminal. That guy should have never been allowed out of prison, ever. The truth all came out, and it's true. There were a couple of witnesses. There was a father and son who were in their backyard, like, cleaning weeds, and they witnessed the whole thing, too. The police found dozens of notebooks in his apartment, rambling essays about how he planned on killing both Lisa and Norma Jean Lara, his first wife, and as well as a married couple that he believed had turned him in for welfare fraud. He was a steaming, angry man. He had went to his daughter's grave, his daughter Heidi's grave, and he was unimpressed with her tombstone. He had given her mother $5,000. He wanted all of his children buried together, but you know, that's how out of touch he was, you know, with just reality. And he wrote all over the place in his books, and the world around me is a jungle. I can trust no one, rely on no one, confide in no one. I am alone in my struggle against the world, abandoned, betrayed, and brutalized. Is it any wonder I am the barbarian that I am? Shoo, boy. So, he got found guilty, and he died in prison, 71. He died in 2003, 18 years after he married Lisa, or after he murdered Lisa, and 39 years after he murdered his three children.
Yeah, I agree with
Talk
you.
Talk about the world not being fair, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. Poor people. Let's talk about another bizarre story again, very visual. You call it the ladies' man. June 12, 1948, victim, December 14, 1948, in Brighton, Victoriano Corrales, and his victims Alberta Gomez and Maria Poldo. And you start in February 1946, and a family event that's interrupted by the oldest daughter. Tell us what his daughter Angela, or his wife Angela, and the daughters are seeing on February 1946, what they avoid as we...
Yeah, in 1946, he was married to a woman named Angelina. They had six kids already. And in February 1946, he was choking Angelina to death in their home. His oldest daughter stepped in and stopped it, and he would have definitely murdered her if she wouldn't have done it. And Angelina just packed up all of her kids and left. They later found out she was living on a farm in outside of Bakersfield, so she went a good 300 miles to get away from this guy. So he moves to Brighton, which right now is California State University, Sacramento, beautiful campus, just like you'd see anywhere, stadiums and all that, lots of trees and that. But in 1948, it was kind of like where people went to burn their garbage and dump things. And the main line to Southern California for the Union Southern Pacific goes right through there. It's a major railroad line. Back then, they had steam engines, so there's constant smoke and soot and dirt all over the place. It was it wasn't even that far out of Sacramento, but it seemed like a world away. It was actually only about 3 miles from where I live right now. So back then, it was just like shacks and mud, and people had gardens and, probably trailers and just whatever. It was just kind of haphazard place, some light industry, things like that. And he lived in a shack that the newspapers described as a garage, and he was about half a mile from the American River. And he worked as a farm laborer, dishwasher. He worked at a cement pipe factory. He got lonely, so he went back to his hometown, Iroputo, Mexico, which is south of Mexico City. It's quite a distance. And he sweet-talked a local woman there, 28-year-old Alberta Gomez, into coming back to Sacramento to live with them. He told her lies that he was, doing good, and he had his own farm and blah, 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 So in June 1948, he smuggled her over the border near Calexico, California, which is famous now for, not only for the border things that are happening, but also because of that band, Calexico, which is one of my favorite bands. You ever heard them? Great band.
Yes.
Yeah. After living with him for a few days, she knew she'd made a terrible mistake, and she said she was going to leave him, and he beat her brains out with a hammer, chopped off her head, arms, and legs, and then wrapped them up, made two trips to the American River to dump her body. Unless that happened at night. But he wrapped her torso in an electric blanket and used the cord as a rope, and that was like springtime, June. There were no dams on the river back then, so the American River was riding high, and the Sacramento River was. Her body washed up 25 miles downstream a couple of weeks later. The other body parts they didn't find. So after a few months, they find the body. They're going like, whoa, what's this body? See that a lot, especially back then. It's like body found in slough, body found in river. So a few months later, he got tired of living alone. He returned to his hometown, found another female to bring back. And she was in her 20s, Maria Pardo. And he said that she was a successful man and coming with me to Sacramento. And so she did. They crossed the border near Calexico again. They arrived in Sacramento, and instead of going right to his house like he did the first time, they stayed at a hotel down in the west end of Sacramento, which was near Old Sac, and the west end was where all the nightclubs were and things. Right. It was destroyed when they put I-5 through the town. They put it right through that neighborhood and destroyed it. So he stayed there for a few days where he acted like he was rich and he was spending money. So he hired a cab a couple of days later, and he took a cab back to Brighton. And when she saw the neighborhood, she recoiled. This, according to the cab driver, she got really angry, and she saw where she was, where they were living. They actually had a physical fight while they were getting out of the car. He dragged her into his house, and he killed her right away. Took the same hammer, hit her over the head, grabbed his axe again, chopped off her head, legs, arms, and took two trips back to the river, tossed her body parts in there, and then he went to sleep. Next day, he cleaned up the place and burned a mattress. So her body was found pretty quickly and not too far away. Like, oof, boy, let's say half a mile from where he dumped her, right by the H Street Bridge. And the autopsy revealed that she was alive when she was decapitated. So they were wondering if there was a connection with the other torso that they found. There was a woman that lived, she was a neighbor of Corrales, Ira Anderson, and she really, she's pretty good interviews in the papers and stuff, and in her picture and stuff. She kind of looked like a 1940s old biddy, like they'd have in the movies and stuff. And she had heard her girlfriends told her about, well, aren't you feel bad about all the murders happening around here? And she was like, she didn't know. And they heard they told her, and she remembered seeing Corrales beating up that woman and burning the mattress, and they never saw her again. And he said that, she won't be here for too long, you know. And she said, oh, what happened to your friend? Oh, you know, she's not here anymore. So she said she never saw these women leave the cabin. She saw them go in, and she was afraid of, you know, if they didn't find the evidence, and she'd be living next door to this guy, you know. So she was very careful about it. But she did tell the police, and they went, and they discovered the bloody double-bladed axe, 6-inch knife on the table. Everything just had blood residue on it. And they took them downtown and dragged the river, and they found the rest of Bordeaux. They found her head. She had her hair still had a ribbon tied in it and everything. And he pleaded not guilty and ended up getting charged with two counts of second degree murder, and found him guilty, sentenced him to death, and he walked calmly into the gas chamber. No one claimed his body. When they tracked down his wife after they found out it was him, she was still terrified of the guy.
Wow.
So here
you talk about
no.
No, go ahead.
No, I'm done with that one. But
okay, you include in this, and you a few of the stories you talk about that likely the confessions that some of these people make in some of these stories were pre Miranda rights era.
Right.
You say, what are you saying there? And what do you say?
Well, I'm
that?
Saying that the cops had things that they could do to get a confession out of somebody, slapping them up, you know, threatening them, interviewing them for hours and hours. You know, the old phone book, get beat with a phone book. You know, those guys knew where to hit you and stuff. And, you know, for sometimes it worked, you know, obviously, but, you know, a lot of times somebody just confessed because they didn't want to get beaten anymore. I mean, so, yeah, you always have to be a little suspicious before, like, 1964 when they said that they got a confession out of them after a certain amount of time or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'd like to talk about another story that you have included, and I mispronounce this, Asesinato Mes Horrible. Like, maybe you could tell us what that translation is. And this is in April 28, 1950, and this victim is Dolinda Montoya Diaz.
First,
tell us what that translation is.
Asesinato Mas Horrible is a murder most horrid. That's what I was trying to get at, but that's as close as I can get. This is one of the most eeriest cases. And again, you know, I've been kind of shocked that I never heard of, like, these cases, because some of them are, you know, just like the last one. It's like, how could that be forgotten? But they, you know, after 60 years, they are forgotten. And this one happened almost 70 years ago. Dolinda, she was a young woman, married. She's beautiful, just beautiful. She was 22 years old, 5'1", you know, 110 pounds, just a little thing. And she worked at a packing company, which is now I-5 goes right through the middle of it. But on April 28th, 1950, which is my birthday, actually 8 years later, her, where she worked, they got a phone call. And this guy said, "This is Nick Diaz. I want to talk to my wife." And they said, "Well, she's on the line right now, but we'll leave a message for her and she'll call you, you know, when she gets her break." And he said, "Tell her there's been a murder in her home and for her to come back home right away." So they thought, "Well, okay, we'll go tell her that." So when she got the message, she appeared startled and immediately left. She ran out the door and was never seen again. The night watchman guy was the last one to see her. About midnight, her husband, Nick, was out at a bar, and they bumped into a coworker of hers. And he says, "Hey, how are things going? You know, Delinda, you know, we heard there was something happened at home." And he was like, "Well, you know, what are you talking about? There's nothing going on." And then he thought, well, her mother was sick. And so maybe she got a call from her sister or brother saying, you know, "Mom's really sick. You better come home." Her parents lived in what's now real suburban Sacramento, but back then it was pretty rural. So he just thought, well, she obviously just ran off to her mom's, you know, and it was late already. It was after midnight when he found out. So when she wasn't home, he just thought, oh, I'll just call in the morning because it's obviously where she is. She's from a close-knit family, you know, Mexicans. They've been in the country about 10 years. She had like 8 brothers and sisters and stuff. So he called there when in the morning, and they said, "Oh, she didn't come here at all or anything." So he went to the police, and the police handled it pretty quietly. They thought, you know, maybe it was a marital spat or something, and there wasn't any leads, though. They were like, "This is, you know, very odd." And so they, you know, the guard was the last person to see her leave. So her description is she had long, dark hair, green eyes, stood 5'2", weighed 125 pounds, and when she left, she was wearing a red-flowered bandana, a black skirt, yellow sweater, and a short, dark green jacket. Pretty stylish, even today, you know, especially for going to work. So those two had been married for a couple of years. When they first got married, they moved to San Jose, but they got tired of the crime there. Their apartment was attempted to be broken in a couple of times. So they just moved back to Sacramento, where their family was anyways. They lived downtown. It's really nothing. You know, they were just a married couple. It wasn't anything different. They were Catholics, and, you know, they celebrated things together and that. So the police couldn't find out anything about it. And they questioned Diaz, her husband, because, you know, they always figure that it's going to be the husband that kills her. And sure. They even had brought in an inspector from Berkeley, the famous cop Albert Riddell, who invented a bunch of techniques that police use to look for clues and things. And so he was not the person. So at the same time, the women at the packing plant, you know, they're all edgy because, you know, one of their coworkers got murdered. And so they started walking in groups after work. You know, they got off work at like late at night. So they started walking in groups. And one time some guy came up and told this one woman to get in their car. And all these women like chased the guy off, throwing their lunch buckets and stuff at the guy. What happened was actually funnier than what I wrote, you know, but what really happened was like they were like, "Not going to take any grief from that guy." So, you know, they tried, they checked out everything. They could not find anything, any clues why she would disappear. Her husband thought that she had been abducted and raped, and that she was with her Catholic guilt and old world sensibilities that she was embarrassed to come back home. But on November 20th, 1950, they found two teenagers were pheasant hunting in the south side of town. And they found her remains. She was pretty much a skeleton with some skin and hair on it. She was killed in an unknown location and then dumped in the field. They dragged her. There's still evidence of her getting dragged from the car about 20 feet and thrown face down into the tall grass. And she had a skull fracture from a single blow of a blunt instrument. she had some rings on. She was identified by dental records, and she had just recently gone to the dentist before she disappeared. They never caught the people that did this, and they have no idea, you know, that it wasn't like her husband or her or their families were involved in any kind of criminal endeavors, you know, where like maybe they'd say like, oh, well, this is a revenge thing or something. Nothing like that. It was just out of the blue, as if they were like somebody like stalked her, you know, saw her as a target, you know, and she's just a, you know, vegetable packer, lettuce packer in a factory, you know. This one woman claimed a few years later that she knew right around that time she'd been in some business, and she saw in the back room there was a naked woman unconscious laying back there and a couple of men. And it turned out that she had been in the mental hospital, and she said that the doctors wouldn't believe her either. But then her mother came out and said that, you know, she'd been in and out of mental hospitals all of her life. The cops went and checked out the guy, and everything cleared out. They never found out a thing. Even with the FBI involved, they never found out who murdered Dolinda Diaz.
What I found just a little bit, I wanted to ask this question, is that it seemed odd that when he received the information from the worker, that the worker hadn't conveyed to him the urgency or even the message, even the gist of the message that was given to his wife, Dolinda, so that she took off from work. And that the worker would have conveyed the gist of that message to him. I just thought it was odd that he wouldn't do that, because certainly if he would have, then he wouldn't have concluded that, well, maybe she went to her mother's, and maybe she didn't leave a note, and maybe she didn't take anything with her. And then his reason when he said, well, I think maybe she'd been sexually assaulted and she was ashamed, mm-hmm. and so maybe she would stay away and not want to see her parents. I don't know. Today, if I was a law enforcement, I'd go, we better sit this guy down, because that kind of language of ashamed, and I don't know. It just seems like not much of a theory, very interesting coming from the husband.
I agree. And he had also brought an attorney with him, which was smart. Everybody should always bring an attorney with them. But he hadn't brought the attorney with him, he could have faced a different type of questioning altogether. That maybe he would have. But I agree. I think that he was involved. Probably not. Maybe not. I don't know. I don't know if the guy's still alive. Guess he would be about 85 now. But it does seem weird that they knew where she was, which direction she was going to go, and did they know her? Did they pull up in a car and say, Dolinda, come on, we'll take you there. We're going to go to the hospital or whatever, and peel off and and no one knows how long she was held before she was murdered or what's, you know. But I agree, her husband was a little too nonchalant about the whole thing.
Like I said, I'd like to know more just in terms of what exactly was said to him. Like I say, I find it hard to believe that he would mention it. Hey, listen, what's the result of what happened with your wife, but then not convey the right message at all, only convey half of it. Oh, she left for some reason. Well, I just find it odd. As a amateur sleuth, I would be looking at that man, and I would want to know more information. So very, very interesting, and very, very, very mysterious and suspicious how, again, like you talk about how the police acted back in the day, and then the just sort of incomplete information that can be found sometimes in how this was just incredibly just, like you say, parole after 10 years even. It's hard to fathom how they've justified that. So incredible.
Oh, yeah.
David, you have all of these stories. How many stories do you have included in this book, Forgotten Sacramento Murders?
I think there's 38 stories in there. And I only picked them from 1940 to 1976 because I wanted them to be the forgotten stories. You know, 1976 was 40-something years ago. I talked to some people who are my age who were, you know, 18, 19 when some of the later stories happened, and they didn't even remember it. Like, a police officer was killed in 1976 in a newspaper. It was page 3 news in our local newspaper.
Yeah, yeah.
Like it happens every day or something, you know. It's like, wow, because you would think that would be front page news now when it happens across the country.
Yeah. Yes. And, you know, you have all of these cases. What we didn't get into was the unsolved double murder of grocery store clerks Philip Latimer and Michael McCandless.
Yeah.
Very interesting case. And then just another, less interest in victims, the hobo Lloyd Gomez murdering 8 men in hobo camps up and down the Central Valley. And the original boogeyman in 1956. In a story that seems to circulate everywhere, a young boy in the downtown movie theater. It seems like it's occurred everywhere, but this is the original story. So
yeah.
I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about Forgotten Sacramento Murders. For those that might want to take a look at the other true crime books that you have, can you tell us about website or Facebook page that you might have?
Yeah, I have a Facebook page, just David Kolchick author page. My other books are still in print and still available. They were on Craven Street Books. California's Deadliest Women was my last one. California's Reflex and Nuts, Death in California, and California Justice, Shootouts, Lynchings, and Assassinations in the Golden State. I found my niche, you know.
Absolutely, absolutely. You certainly have. I want to thank you very much for coming on and telling us just a few of the stories here in Forgotten Sacramento Murders. It's always a pleasure, David. Thank you very much, and hope to talk to you again real soon. You have a great night. Thank you.
Thank you very much, too. It's always an honor.
Good night, David. Thank you.
Night.